meet to order. For those of you who may care, House Bill 2278 is being pulled from the agenda, so we will have neither a work session nor a we will have neither a public hearing nor a work session. Again, as House Bill 2278 has been pulled from the agenda. Let's see. With that, then, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2131. And, Patrick, how about giving us a little bit of rundown on this bill?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2131 authorizes state and local government issuers of bonds to enter in agreements for exchange of interest rates. It declares the obligation of the governmental unit backed by full faith and credit and taxing power to be an enforceable contract and commits the governmental unit to raise sufficient revenue to repay the obligation. The bill grants exclusive jurisdiction to the tax court to determine whether the use of the proceeds of bonded indebtedness is authorized. It also authorizes the expenditure of revenue raised by the local option taxes beyond the period of years during which a local option may be levied. Finally, the bill modifies the authority of state and local governments to issue and administer bonds. Also included, members, in your packet are the Dash 1 amendments to the bill. They were brought at the request of some of the people who become to testify.
Okay. Just to let you know, members, you'll note that this is not scheduled for a work session today. What I really wanted to do is get this opened up from a standpoint of finding out what the issues are and helping us understand what this will mean. And then at some point in the probably near future, after we've had a chance to really look at the amendments and that sort of thing, we will then bring the bill back for a work session later. So, let's see. Let me have Pat Clancy come on up. And does he want to come with
you?
I was just going to say, if Harvey would like to come up with you, that would be fine. And if you would, make sure that you state your name for the record. And I'll go ahead and leave it to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, member of the committee. I'm Patrick Clancy. I'm the chair of the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. Municipal Debt Advisory Commission is a seven-member commission made up of four local government officers, one state government officer, and two members at large appointed by the state to review the status of municipal debt issuance within the state. Each 2 years, we hold a series of hearings in which we solicit input from local governments and individuals across the state as to problems that they've had with the current statutes, the Oregon law, in terms of issuing debt and changes that they'd like to see made in the Oregon statutes. We went through that process this last year, held a few public hearings, received testimony. And as a result of that, the commission considered a variety of proposals that were brought forth, decided on which ones of those that seemed to have merit, and then asked local bond councils to help us draft language, which was then sent to the legislative council to be put in the form of the bill that you have. The amendments you have are subsequent changes to the legislative council's bill because legislative council and bond councils and the commission were working together to try and get the language right, and there were some technical changes that we felt that needed to happen to legislative council's draft of the bill to make it conform to the purposes that the commission had originally set forth. And so these are all consistent with our original intentions. The bill that you have before you does a number of things, and as I said, we sort of gather up all these comments, and so you really have sort of a potpourri of items that are attempts to fix a number of things that are going on in Oregon law. In terms of new items, and the header item on this bill is the interest rate agreements, which are known within the industry as swaps and various ways to issue debt and to hedge risk that are widely used across the nation but are not allowed under Oregon law. for a number of years, these have been products that have been used elsewhere in the country. The vast majority of states now allow these agreements. We believe they're sort of complicated, and we've set forth a series of a rulemaking process within this bill so that the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission will establish rules to sort of govern the process and sort of limit the use of these swaps and make sure that people understood what they were doing when they engaged in them. But they are a way to lower the cost of debt for governments if used properly, and we believe that it's an important change in Oregon law consistent with national debt issuance processes. The rest are more technical in nature. The full faith and credit section of this, in the last couple of legislative sessions, governments have been allowed to issue obligations that, in essence, were a general fund pledge of the organization. We pledge whatever it is. We promise to pay back from all of our available resources the bonds that are issued. The statutes are a little unclear. Language at the national level is varying, and we felt that we needed to define exactly what it was that the state and had authorized local governments to do, and that's what this section does. We also formalize the ability of councils of government to issue debt. It's another governmental entity, and they have no express authority under current law to do that, although all the entities that make up those councils of government do have that ability, and so we want to allow them to issue debt as well. We eliminate in the bill the requirement to use a pricing advisor, something that was established a few sessions ago and we feel like has really not proven to be anything but a burden on governments, and we make that something that's optional at this point in time in the bill. We assign jurisdiction to the tax court for matters related to bond proceeds in this bill. The hopes in that is to expedite the process of discussing whether or not a local government can spend the money that it's raised, make the process through the courts clearer, because that's not clear for that particular use at this point in time. The bill clarifies statutes that allow money that is collected in a special levy during the 5-year special levy or 10-year special levy to be actually spent, even though it may be collected during that period of time. The projects might linger over the end of those levy periods. For instance, a road project that might be building for 2 or 3 years after the levy has been collected, but they wanted to collect the levy first, allows them to go ahead and spend the proceeds. The current statutes aren't clear that you can spend money that you have collected during the normal levy period after the levy is ended, and we think that that's a clarification. And then there are a number of very technical clarifications trying to mend together a number of conflicts within the bill where different statutes were changed under Measure 5 and other ones weren't, and try and make some consistencies. For details along those lines, I brought Harvey Rogers, who's been working with the commission to get this bill in draft form.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Harvey Rogers. I'm a partner at Preston Gates and Ellis. We are the sort of weird lawyers that are known as nationally recognized bond counsel, and I'm privileged, and my firm are privileged to represent a variety of state agencies and local governments all over the state, and we were one of the contributors of legislative suggestions to the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. I also was the lawyer who came down and discussed the recommended language and the changes with legislative counsel, and I would incidentally like to take a moment to thank legislative counsel for the cooperative attitude they've showed in this process. You may know that some time ago, you could hand draft language to legislative counsel, and if it looked sort of lawyerly, they would stamp it and send it on its way, and you folks have discovered that that wasn't always in the public interest, so now legislative counsel looks real hard at stuff. They ask good questions, and they try and understand. That slows things down a little bit sometimes, but it's been a helpful process, and I think the bill that is before you is actually in better shape than when we submitted it. I just wanted to take a moment. The bulk of the bill is the very technical stuff that Pat mentioned. And what is going on there is that when Measure 5 passed, Measure 5, constitutional amendment to the Oregon property tax system back in 1990, introduced a whole bunch of language that nobody had ever seen before. And folks needed a mechanism for figuring out what it meant. So the mechanism that was developed is that the Oregon Tax Court was given exclusive jurisdiction of those questions. And then when Measure 50 passed, the tax court was given exclusive jurisdiction of Measure 50 questions. Kind of high-centered between that, between those constitutional issues and the regular court's jurisdiction, was the question of how do you use general obligation bond proceeds. General obligation bonds are bonds that need to be approved by the voters at a general election in an even-numbered year or where a majority of voters turn out. If they get that approval, they get to raise property taxes, and the statutes in the Constitution put a bunch of restrictions on what you can have in that kind of a ballot and how you can spend the money. And it turned out we just had a conflict in the law about where you could go to resolve those questions, because the constitutional issues were in the tax court exclusively and the other issues were in the regular courts. So what the long sections at the end do is they give the tax court exclusive jurisdiction to resolve the bond proceeds use questions. And they had about three quarters of that anyway. As I say, I was involved in the drafting, and if any of you have questions about it, I would be tickled to try and respond. Otherwise, I'm going to shut up and not take more of your time.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions from committee members? Okay. I have a couple of questions. Excuse me, Representative Nelson.
Yes. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Clancy and Mr. Rogers, for being here. I'm just curious. It seems like we keep passing these laws, and then we put all these administrative rules with them, and the rules do not enforce legislative intent. And so I'm curious, as you have, you know, amended this procedure, have you likewise worked on the administrative rules that go with them?
Go ahead. Representative Nelson, members of the committee, this is one area of law that is relatively administrative rule free. These statutes deal primarily with the borrowings of local governments, and these are generally grants of power to local government with restrictions that, and the local governments operate on them directly without intermediate administrative rules. There's some minor exceptions for the involvement of Treasury. The particular case here would be the agreements, the interest rate exchange agreements, where Treasury is given rulemaking authority to protect the public interest. Those rules have not yet been drafted. So bulk of this bill, no administrative rules at all.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, what about, there's no mandate in here, right?
Mandate.
I'm on the issue of eliminating all these unfunded mandates. So, mandates in here at all?
No mandates.
You protected our municipalities?
We're merely clarifying their ability to do things. We're not telling them they've got to do anything.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, sir.
In the section dealing with the Council of Governments, question that I have is that is that basically going to be any recognized MPO, municipal planning organization?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, councils of governments are ancient entities in Oregon. They have been around for just really since Methuselah was a pup. And what they are cooperative groups of governments that get together to share costs. Mm-hmm. And they are sort of indirectly authorized under Oregon Revised Statutes Chapter 190 under a set of statutes that just say governments can enter into agreements.
Right.
So they're sort of as an analog. They're like partnerships of governments. But partnership law doesn't apply to governments, and so those groups of governments can't operate as a group to borrow money. And so this set of amendments allows them to do that. If you're not a traditional council of governments, there's a separate path to getting to the same place under ORS Chapter 190 and something called an intergovernmental entity
right.
that folks can form.
Okay. Okay. And then with regards to the general fund obligation, and I understand GO bonds and that sort of thing, but can... I didn't see it in here, and hopefully I didn't miss it, but I'm just the question comes up based on the testimony, and that is with regard to the debt obligation for ongoing expenses, there's not a this isn't a mechanism that a local government would utilize to be able to basically bond operational type of expenses.
No, these would be bonds. It would be just for capital purposes.
Okay.
They have to fit under the IRS codes for tax exempt purposes, which in general don't allow working capital borrowings. There are some instances in which they can borrow for operational expenses under Oregon law, such as tax anticipation notes or revenue anticipation notes.
Right. Okay.
This obligation really just clarify, it doesn't allow for a new purpose for borrowing, but rather it allows for a different pledge of security. And so the security that's in this is, we sort of have this funny mix. You have general obligation bonds, which require you to go out and get a vote, and you pledge the property taxes. We have revenue bonds in which you can pledge a specific set of revenues to pay for that debt over time. And broadly defined, you can write the definition of revenues to include most of what you've got. But what this is more or less allowing the equivalent of a corporate general obligation bond. In other words, whatever we've got, it's pledged to pay the bonds. And so this is really about authorizing a different security arrangement for a bond, not about different purposes. So there's nothing in here that speaks to the purpose of issuing the bonds or broadens the purposes under Oregon bonding statutes.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I may, just following on what Pat said, what this section really does is clarify the meaning of something that governments have been doing for a long time. There wasn't anything in statute that said when a government pledged full faith and credit what that really meant. So this is what lawyers got together and say, well, that shouldn't be a hole. We should say what that means. And as Pat says, it doesn't authorize anything new that people aren't doing. It just clarifies what they've already been doing.
Okay, great. Thank you. Did you have another question, Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you. Chair Cromwell, just one question. Because I was in this circumstance, I wanted to, before, what entities have supported this change?
Well, different entities have brought forth a variety of change. This bill, as I said, is like this amalgamation of the thoughts of dozens of entities, and so we have different supporters for different sections and put them into a single bill. We've heard from a number of, on the commission, are representatives of the Association of Counties, the League of Cities, special governments, and school districts. And so each one of the commission members, in theory, has checked back with their associations to talk to them about the various bills that have come through and have signified support for the bills through their various associations. If there's a particular part of the bill that you have a question about, I might be able to dredge up the specific person or entity that brought in that particular one.
Follow up.
You know, I have a concern that, and I'm sure you're you know, working on the behalf mm-hmm. of these entities. Do you have any documents that these entities have endorsed this bill?
Endorsements, no.
Representative Nelson, members of the committee. This overstates it, and I certainly, you should make an independent determination. But if you sort of wanted to chop this bill into two pieces, you would chop it into one interesting piece and another really boring piece. And the really boring piece is most of the bill. Those provisions are largely selected by bond lawyers and, to a certain extent, other finance professionals because they represent sort of glitches. They don't seem to be things that anybody really cares about. They're things that just sort of don't work right. And the process, as Pat mentioned, is that people who had ideas about this brought it before the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, which has, what, three public members and then representatives, four public members, and representatives from each of the component local government groups. And they sort of took a look at these things and said, was this helpful or not? Some things didn't survive, either because they were too boring to raise or because people didn't think they represented appropriate public policy. So that's it, and those sort of very technical things are the whole backside of the bill. The first part, which is the part that authorizes agreements for the exchange of interest rates, which is what we think of as the substantive provision, was in fact supported by a number of governments. And I believe Tom Johnson from the Port of Portland is actually here to testify in favor of that provision. The Oregon Department of Transportation favored the thing. City of Portland appeared to testify in favor of it. What that bill does is in certain market cases, allows governments to save money when they borrow. And this procedure has not been available in Oregon, and all of us in municipal finance practice have had a number of cases where people have gone, oh, geez, I really wish we could do that because we could save some money. But City of Portland, ODOT, and Port of Portland
all testified
actively in favor of it, and I believe TriMet also.
TriMet was there, yeah.
Was there.
We do have minutes of those meetings because we do that. We'd be glad to give you if you'd like to see those.
I would appreciate if you wouldn't mind to have someone from your office give my LA a list of those who've endorsed this bill.
Great.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for these gentlemen? Gentlemen, thank you very much. And also, I would note that I appreciate your comments about Legislative Council. We think they do a pretty good job, too.
Yes, excellent.
Thank you. Thank you.
Let me have Dennis, is it Kilwaite? And Tom Johnson, do you guys mind coming up together?
You'll have to excuse me. I signed up for the wrong bill.
Hmm. Okay, and you are?
I didn't mean to do that, so I was accident. So just scratch my
hand. You are here for it. Okay. Okay.
But it was nice to meet you.
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, representatives, my name is Tom Johnson. I'm the Senior Manager of Corporate Finance for the Port of Portland, which in English means I manage the debt portfolio for the Port of Portland. I won't bore you today, but I do want to testify in support of 2131, in particular the provisions that deal with the interest rate exchange agreements, the way they're phrased in here. This is an important tool for debt management to issuers in the state, and a lot of us have been asking in order to have the tool, and it's like having a hammer in your toolbox. When you need the hammer, you want to be able to get at it. When you need a saw, you really don't need a hammer. In some cases, this is just a tool we have not had. In the Port's case, to be a little bit more specific, we've got about $500 million of debt outstanding at Portland International Airport. It's also a credit rating of AA- without insurance. It's one of the highest rated airport credits in the country. So even with that amount of debt, the credit standing is still very good. Given the conditions in this country and in the airport industry since 9/11 and the economy, our customers out there, the airlines, as opposed to the people who are using the airport, all the people in this region, the airlines are looking to us to reduce costs any way we can. And simply put, a tool like this, if we could shave 0.5 point of interest on one-fifth of our outstanding debt, which sounds like a pretty small percentage, that's $500,000 a year. That's pretty significant money. And we're not alone out there. So I'd be happy to respond to any questions, but I just wanted to lend our voice in support of this measure.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Johnson? Representative Nelson.
Just curious, Chair Krummel, and Mr. Johnson, why is it taking us so long to do this?
I think we may need a cup of coffee on that one. Interest rate swap agreements, when they were originally proposed a number of years ago, came up at a time when anything that was that could be colored as a derivative product came across as something very, very bad, very suspicious. That's not in many ways where these kinds of things fit. You needed to build a kind of a coalition within the state. I think it gets back to your question, Representative Nelson, about how many people are really actively wanting to do something like this as opposed to just one or two. I saw some research that I think there are like 35 or 36 states that have this legislation now. That I wouldn't want to swear to that. That's my memory. That number could be off. And I don't. I imagine they've all gone through the same process of, you know, I don't know who was the beta case, but we're up and we've got a good body of support for this measure, and I'm happy that it's now here in front of the legislature.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Mr. Johnson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else? That ends the people that I had signed up to testify on House Bill 2131. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify? Seeing that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2131. And members, probably sometime in the next week, we will we will see this bill again, and we'll bring it in for work session at that time. Thank you. Okay. I closed the public hearing now already, right? Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2246. And we have a couple of people signed up to testify on this. Bill Carpenter, let me have you come forward first. And oh, yeah. Patrick, give us a – I'm sorry. I'm going to hold you off for just a second. Patrick, give us the lowdown on this, please.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2246 allows the Department of Housing and Community Services to charge fees for providing persons with intellectual property acquired or developed by the department. It appropriates money from those fees to the department. The bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. However, we haven't received a fiscal impact statement on that yet, and I will continue checking on that.
Okay. Great, thank you. Okay. Now, Mr. Carpenter, if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Carpenter. I'm the administrator of the Information Services Division of the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you this morning to speak in support of House Bill 2246. As Mr. Brennan explained, this allows us to be reimbursed for the costs of developing certain software applications and collecting specialized data when we provide them to interested non-government parties. And let me give you a little background about that. Our department's currently authorized under statute to provide partners and stakeholders with the data and information they need to assist them delivering effective housing and community services to low-income Oregonians. We have under statute a rather unique position. We are the source of reliable housing data for Oregonians, and because of that, we have developed tools that have become a necessary part of our business processes. We share these tools with partners and stakeholders to assist them in delivering affordable housing and providing quality community services. One example, we have a housing needs model that provides forecasts of housing needs for specific areas, such as cities and counties that use it to conduct the state-mandated periodic reviews, land use planning, economic development, applying for grants, and similar uses. This housing needs model is also used by many non-government parties who need to obtain information on housing needs for their particular market area. We provide this model free of charge to public entities, and this practice would continue after the law change. Some non-government entities, such as consultants, have asked to purchase the model itself from us for use in their businesses and would like to be able to do that. That way, those that are actually profiting from the model and the data collections that support it are the ones that would be paying for the cost of maintaining it and enhancing it. It's kind of a market incentive for us to do a good job on the model and keeping it current and meeting their needs. As a department, OHCS can gather and purchase the needed data and develop the models more effectively and at a lower cost than having all of the partners do it individually. By allowing us to recover those costs by licensing and charging customers, we'll be able to enhance the model and use it to obtain updated data and add improvements. I want to state that we're not interested in competing with private sector data vendors or software companies, but because of our position as a kind of repository of housing data for Oregon, we're providing tools that are otherwise unavailable. Second example is a web-based software application we've developed that we call Opus. It collects data from field staff, and it's used for program administration of several community services energy programs. For instance, the low-income energy assistance program is distributing something like $11 million in assistance to vendors and clients through the Opus program. We have other companies that are interested in using this for processing energy program payments that are not programs of our department. And again, this change to statute would allow us to provide this service to utility companies and other interested organizations. This amendment, as I said, would allow us to continue to develop and provide necessary tools for our partners. That helps them make more informed policy decisions and better address the housing and community service needs within their service areas. Passage of this amendment will allow us to maximize the efficiency and effectiveness with which we fulfill our unique role as a value-added provider of data and analysis to our business partners and other government agencies. Again, we want to charge the people that find it useful, and we find that an effective use of limited state resources, where those who use the tools are the ones that actually pay for them. It will also further our department goal to maintain affordable housing and provide community services throughout the state. This bill has no fiscal impact, and I'm sorry we haven't gotten a fiscal impact statement to you, Mr. Brennan, but we'll do that. Again, we ask for your support of House Bill 2246, and thanks for the opportunity to talk about it this morning. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Carpenter? Representative Nelson, are you...
I'll go in the queue after her.
No, that's okay. Representative Przanski, we'll give Representative Nelson's voice a rest.
Thank you.
Just a couple of questions. The database or the product that you're wanting to market, will it be a database that will include sensitive or personal information of individual clients within the housing authority?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Przanski, no, there's no client level information in the model that we have. It's all summary.
It's all what?
Summary information.
Okay.
High level.
Follow-up?
City or county level.
Just want to clarify, because you had said that you're a depository of information that other people are not able to get, as to what type of information that would include. And what I'm hearing, it does not include personal data or information of individuals?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Anything else? Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Chair Krimmel. I'm not sure I understood that answer to your question, which is a very good question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, we don't collect personal information on individuals, and we would not make that available through these services or tools we're talking about.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Mr. Carpenter, what information is it then that is not available elsewhere?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, we collect information about housing stock, number of low-income individuals in certain in all areas of the state, and we forecast the future need for single-family housing, multiple housing by specific areas throughout the state.
Thank you. To follow up, please.
Follow up.
I heard yesterday, very interesting on the news, was what has gotten cheaper, you know, as you look back in life on everything we buy. Can you think of anything that's gotten cheaper?
Not
and the answer
I'm not sure I recognize the relevancy to that.
You won't until I tell you the answer. The only thing that's gotten cheaper, according to New York Times or somebody, is communications. And so I'm just, that's interesting, and I wonder, what's the rate base? What are you going to charge for this information based on what?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, that's actually a very interesting question. And it would depend on the product and who wanted it. If we have 10 people that are interested in a model that costs us $1,000 a year to maintain, then we can only get reimbursed for our costs. So at that point, they'd each pay $100. If we were developing an entirely new model, then we'd have to work with the partners and our fiscal people to determine what a fair charge would be for an entirely new product. But again, we're only talking about being reimbursed for our actual expenses. It's not a profit center for us.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. What is your projection of how much revenue you're going to bring back to this department?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, I don't have a projection. I'll be happy to work with you or your staff to try to answer those questions, but I don't know.
Looks like we have somebody in the audience that can answer that.
Who may know that question, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Rick Krager. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Oregon Housing Community Services, and I do apologize for the fact that you don't have a fiscal impact. There was one prepared, so just to give you an idea as related to the model that Mr. Carpenter is referring to, approximately about $16,500 in total revenue is what we'd anticipate. Obviously, we don't know. We're only basing that on what we believe the demand would be, and that constitutes probably about excuse me, about 78 requests during the 2003-2005 biennium. So.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chair Primo. I did not get your name.
I'm sorry, Rick Krager.
Rick Krager?
Yeah.
Mr. Krager, can anybody acquire this information? Can anybody on earth get this information from you, or is it restricted in any way?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, in terms of getting this information, absolutely. We are open to discussions with all public entities and being able to provide that particular information, yes.
And private citizens?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Bakken.
Thank you. Do you anticipate developing new products or new databases tailored to the specific requests of buyers, or do you just plan on selling the existing, for lack of a better word, products that you have?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Avakian, we have been asked to develop some new models, so I would anticipate that in addition to existing products, there would be some new products as well.
And Mr. Chair?
Follow up. Go ahead.
Will this involve any particular organized marketing plan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Avakian, no, I have no plans to market this.
Okay.
That's all.
I have a couple of questions. So the money that's raised from this, I just want to clarify this, that's raised by this would go back into the department. So I didn't see in the bill, and maybe I just missed it, is there a place where the money is continuously appropriated then on a revenue and expenditure cycle for the department?
Mr. Chairman, in terms of our fiscal impact, what we have anticipated is that we would absorb that within our expenditure limitation as it currently stands, and then this would only have a revenue impact to reimburse us for the staff cost that we would anticipate. Now, we did, on the fiscal impact, and once again, I apologize for you not having that, we did anticipate about $5,700 in abiding in terms of new expenditure need, and that was based on the fact that occasionally we will be provided technical assistance to individuals using that, and that's not something planned and part of our position, so we might have a need to bring in, you know, temporary type work to go in and help in that particular area.
Okay. So the department would actually trademark this product, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, probably we would copyright the product.
Copyright it as opposed to trademark. Yeah. And is it based on an open source software or platform, or is it like a Windows based or?
Mr. Chairman, the current models use Microsoft Excel, and we use some Oracle database. So I'd call them open products.
Okay. I've never seen anybody that's able to get the source code from Microsoft.
Well, in that sense, you're right, sir. It's not an open product.
Now, you mentioned that that the revenue impact would be about $16,500. What's the actual cost of development to the department for developing the software in the first place?
Mr. Chairman, in terms of my impact, basically, we had seen this in terms of collection over time period and maintenance on an ongoing basis. The development piece that I had put in, that $16,500, was about $10,800. And this is, once again, identifying the housing development model. Now, we currently have a process as we develop new software. We're required by accounting rules to look at that development piece. This particular software, the housing model, I think goes way beyond the $10,800 that we actually are absorbing in the next 2003-2005 biennium. Estimates that I run early on was somewhere in the neighborhood of $20,000 to $25,000.
So a revenue impact of $16,500 really doesn't cover your development costs then?
That's correct.
So then in that case, it would have a fiscal impact, an expenditure impact.
Mr. Chairman, in terms of this particular development, this is a software that the agency has developed. I mean, it's already in place at this point. So whatever revenue we collect would be reimbursing past expenses that we had actually included.
So, but as you, if you've got a software developer kind of sitting in the basement of your offices, glued to a screen all day and working on developing new products, then you have a cost of development involved.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. At this point, we don't anticipate, unless we're developing new software, I think Mr. Carpenter talked about the Opus product. That's part of our mission and our goals and objectives as we create that. Just happens as we do that, there is a use outside. It's not our intent, as Mr. Carpenter explained, to sit down and market and develop software on an ongoing basis to be marketing to the public. These are just tools that we have designed as an agency as part of our responsibility as housing and community services that we have found a need and a use by outside partners.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair. These are integral parts of our business processes, and we would continue to develop and use them anyway.
Okay. And do you contract or have you contracted before with private software developers to kind of help put this together? Is this sort of a software expert that's employed full-time by the department that then?
Mr. Chairman, these were developed by our staff. We have not employed contractors to develop software products. We do buy third-party software when that makes business sense rather than develop our own software.
Okay. And From a standpoint of looking at the IT department that is within DAS, is this a Department of Administrative Services, is this a sort of a recognized mission on the part? I mean, has, I guess what I'm asking is it has the IT department overall, the state IT department sort of blessed this and said, yes, we think this is a good deal, and go forth and develop, and if you can sell it and recover costs, and that's a good deal?
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to speak on behalf of DAS, but I have talked with Mr. Gene Newton of the DAS Information Resources Management Division, and he's told me he thought this was a good idea, and actually I think had some interest in expanding it for other agencies.
Okay. Okay. There was and that's good. Are there any other questions for either of these gentlemen, Representative Nelson?
Just a quick one, Chair Crummell. It was my understanding that real estate agencies can purchase this information.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, yes, that's correct.
But this is, to clarify, this is actually an applications type of software that you're taking information that's in the public domain and plugging it into the applications, and then you're able to come up with forecasting, for example, of where housing stocks are, what housing stock is available, what sort of price ranges they might be in, and that sort of thing. Is that, am I correct?
Exactly, Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay.
Couldn't have said any better ourselves.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Jim Mulder?
Good morning.
Whenever you're ready, go ahead. Thank you.
My name is Jim Mulder. I'm the Director of Community Development for the City of Woodburn. And I'd like to go on record in support of House Bill 2246. The City of Woodburn recently utilized the housing model that was just talked about. We used it in preparing the city's housing needs assessment. That was part of our state-mandated periodic review work program. We utilized that model in developing that, and it was very, very important and helpful using that model, because it helped the city avoid the cost and time that would have been necessary to prepare our own model. And based on that, I'd like to again express my support for that model. It's something that can be used by all jurisdictions in the state, and it helps us again avoid the cost and time that would be involved in developing our own models, and with the state being able to recoup some of the costs of developing that, it would provide a means for them to maintain and keep that model updated for our use. I appreciate your time.
Okay. Did you find the model to be very reliable in terms of what you found in the field versus what you found when you plugged the information into the model?
More or less. Again, the model is, I'm sure if you ask their staff, it's continually being updated.
Mm-hmm.
It's not perfect. No model is perfect. But it was very useful. And again, if we didn't have the model, and we had to go on our own, especially trying to meet the state and satisfy a DLCD and performing our housing needs assessment, it at least provides kind of a level field for jurisdictions to work off of instead of everyone developing their own model, which may or may not comply with state requirements.
Okay. Did you pay a cost to the department for access to the software?
It was provided to the city for free.
It was provided, yes, for free. Okay. Great. Thank you. Are there any other questions? Mr. Mulder, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill 2246? Seeing none, members, just for your information, we will bring this back most likely at some point in the future, although there's a couple of things that I myself want to kind of look into before we actually do that. So with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2246, and we will now move to House Bill 2169, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2169. And Patrick, if you would give us the lowdown on this bill.
I'd be glad to, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2169 authorizes the Housing and Community Services Department to use Guarantee Fund Housing Development and Guarantee Account to guarantee loans on commercial components of structures that contain both commercial property and low-income housing. The bill allows for a preference for certain properties in the granting of loan guarantees. Members, I mentioned this bill. We received a statement of minimal fiscal impact from the Legislative Fiscal Office on this bill. It has no revenue impact.
Okay, great. Thank you. Let me have Bob Gillespie come forward from OHCS. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Kremel, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Gillespie. I'm the administrator of the Housing Division for the Oregon Housing Community Services Department. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to speak in favor of House Bill 2169. This bill makes important changes to our loan guarantee program in that it allows the department to provide guarantees on the commercial portions of developments of properties that have both housing and commercial aspects to them. I'd like to give you just a brief introduction to the loan guarantee program and then explain a little bit more about the importance of doing mixed-use development around the state. The Oregon Housing and Community Services Loan Guarantee Program provides guarantees to lenders in the financing of new housing or for the acquisition of existing structures for rehabilitation and to provide housing for persons of low and very low income. The guarantees can be provided for an amount up to 25% of the original principal balance of the loan. We do have preferences in the statute for those developments that provide periods of long-term affordability and also for special needs service programs, particularly for populations like frail elderly or other disabled populations. Although developments around the state may contain both commercial and residential elements, when using the Oregon Housing Fund as the source of the guarantee, current law restricts us in providing loan guarantees to only the housing portions of those projects. And particularly given the importance of revitalizing downtowns and today's current economy, and we hear this from our local partners and local communities, I believe there's multiple benefits in doing the mixed-use developments that we're speaking about today. One of these is that most of our community partners believe that this brings a sense of stability and vitality to the local communities, and particularly when you're bringing the residents back into the downtown areas of the communities. It no longer becomes just a 9-to-5 workplace, and they don't roll the sidewalks up at 5. There tends to be a longer term of activity in the downtown areas. These developments also take advantage of underutilized or abandoned commercial spaces that provides new economic opportunities to the downtown areas and, you know, adds a sense of economic well-being to the downtown areas. It also has the advantage of bringing workforce housing back into the area that is proximate to those portions of the community that offer many of the job opportunities. It reduces the commuting time and reduces traffic in these communities. And if we're doing special needs housing, much of the services that are available for special needs housing are in the core area of the city. So this would bring the housing that's proximate to the services and affording those persons with special needs an opportunity to access the services easier and have an easier time in reaching level of self-sufficiency. We have done some developments in this last biennium that I think are of significance. I'd like to use as an illustration. In downtown Pendleton on Main Street, there was a variety store that burned out several years ago and left an eyesore right in the middle of downtown Pendleton. With the funding that was available, both public and private, we went back in and redeveloped that site, and it has now a ground floor retail and then three stories of housing on top of it. And if you look at the development, it fits into the character of Pendleton. It adds an asset to the downtown community, and as opposed to just having a vacant, blighted spot. The second one we did was the development of the Commodore Hotel in downtown The Dalles. And this particular development is on 2nd Street in downtown The Dalles. It's directly opposite the City Hall, right in the heart of the community. And the Commodore Hotel was a quarter-block building that was four stories tall that had been abandoned for decades. And the discussion within the community was, well, should we tear it down and make a parking lot, or should we try to revitalize it? It was in that type of condition. And we did go back in with our partners, and we redeveloped the building into ground floor retail that didn't exist. Well, the fourth story is dynamic office spaces with wonderful views, and then has second and third story housing in this development. And again, this is a much better asset for the community than a parking lot would have been. The House Bill 2169 would allow us to make loan guarantees on these types of developments. Well, there's no cost to the state with this change. The change will benefit our partner affordable housing investors. And investors in these types of developments have a good understanding of affordable housing development. They're comfortable with making assessments of the risk of doing affordable housing development. Their understanding and their comfort level with doing the commercial portion of it isn't as great. So by the department being able to provide the opportunity of having a loan guarantee program will give us another tool so that we can encourage this type of activity around the state. It would reduce the risk to the lenders. It would enable more affordable housing types of these types of mixed-use projects to be developed, and it would benefit more of the downtown communities around the state. And there was a fiscal impact on this. There is no additional cost to the state associated with extending the loan guarantees to cover the commercial aspects of these projects, as the processing of these guarantees can be absorbed by current staff. In summary, we know that extending the loan guarantee to cover the commercial aspects of affordable housing projects will strengthen these projects and the communities that they're developed in. We urge your support of House Bill 2169, and I do appreciate the opportunity to have spoken with you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Now, I want to clarify one thing real quickly, if I may, kind of jumping out in front of my members here, and that is, did I hear you say that there is a fiscal impact?
There is not.
There is not. Okay, I just wanted to clarify, because I thought I heard you say that there is a fiscal impact, but then there wasn't, and so I was just trying to make sure that, so there is no fiscal impact, and any additional work can easily be absorbed by the staff that is currently in the department.
That's correct. If I didn't make that clear, it must have been my Midwestern drawl.
Thank you. And one other question I'm going to jump out in front on, and that is with regards to the Commodore in the Dalles and Goodwin Court in Pendleton. You didn't do anything that would violate state law, from current state law, from a standpoint of those. So was the commercial part of it just not guaranteed within the loan? Or I guess I'm trying to figure out, if it wasn't permitted, sort of how you finessed that with.
Sure, Colonel. That's a good question. The Goodwin Court in Pendleton, I think, probably had an easier time in the development, in the sense that they created the retail space with a platform on top of it, and then three stories of housing on top of that, so you could condominiumize the spaces, even though the condominiumization, that's a hard word to say, condominiumization of the spaces,
okay,
created a lot of expense to the developer. You had a clear line of demarcation between the retail and the residential. the case of the Commodore in the Dalles, where you have an existing structure, it's much more difficult to divide the property between the retail and the commercial portions of it. As a matter of fact, the developer is still struggling with that very issue, even though the project is developed. There's certain forms of finance, and particularly the tax-rated equity, that is uncomfortable with making their agreements with them until there's some way to handle the risk that's associated with the commercial portions of the property.
Okay. But the projects have been successful. I mean, they've got people living in the housing units. They've got tenants in the retail aspects of it. And so from that standpoint, they are successful.
Chair Krimmel, the Goodwin Court has more of a history. It's done first. All the retail space is leased up, and the units, the residential units, are leased up in a hurry. It's my understanding the Commodore has leased up, I think, 50% of the commercial space, and they're leasing up the housing spaces. So they're on track with the schedule that they developed for their lease-up schedule.
I'm going to ask one more question, members. With regards to the commercial space, I'm just curious. Last session, we addressed the issue for what are being referred to as microenterprises. Basically, small businesses get started for $35,000 or less. Some lottery money is being sort of put into that and that sort of thing. Where these units, where the housing side of the units are being utilized for low and very low income types of housing.
Right.
Are the business spaces also sort of being slanted towards microenterprise, small businesses that might be struggling to get started, but people really want to get them started, or is the commercial side of it basically going for whatever the rate is in the local area? So if the rate is a triple net $1.10 a square foot, is that help me out with that one?
Sure, Carmel. I believe that the commercial spaces, it has been the habit of the developers to try to lead the commercial market and not, to offer spaces at a reduced rate, and particularly to try to revitalize the downtown areas. It's the philosophy that if you have rates that are at the upper end of the market, you provide a good product, you tend to draw the other products along, the other rest of the community along with you, enabling private reinvestment and maintenance of the properties in the downtown area. So that's been the habit that I've seen in these two developments that we're speaking of. I don't think there's any reason that we couldn't have some portion of it be microenterprise developments or startup businesses, particularly working in cooperation with the Community Solutions team or the Department of Economic and Community Development.
Okay. One of the things that would be interesting to see would be if in communities, particularly in rural Oregon, the Dalles, Pendleton, John Day, places like that, and I'm just sort of making this as an editorial comment, but might be kind of interesting to see is if there was a way of sort of combining it. And for a developer, this might be a real tough call because they maybe couldn't make it pencil out. And if they can't make the project pencil, we know they're not going to build it. But in addition to having the low-income housing, sort of setting up the commercial aspect of it or part of the commercial aspect of it, kind of like an incubator,
right.
A business incubator, and see how that kind of a model might work. It's just a thought that I kind of throw out on the table.
That's a very good thought.
So, anyway, other questions, members? Are you looking at me like that because you have a question?
Of course. I have a question because this is close to my heart.
Well,
this homeless issue. Thank you, and I'm going to take advantage of it every time I have a chance. How many units do we need of low-cost housing for this state in this horrible situation of homelessness?
Well, the Chair Cromwell and Representative Nelson, there's different ways of counting the need for units for affordable housing. One statistic that is used is called the unmet housing need, which is households that are below 50% of median income and are paying more than 30% of their income for housing assistance and not for housing and not receiving any governmental assistance. And the last figures that I saw on this, that are, there was about 110,000 households in the state of Oregon that will fall into that category. So the demand is significantly beyond the capability, the resources at this current time.
Follow up. I'm just curious, what is the risk that is so that has prevented this from, this guarantee from being in place before? I mean, what is such a high risk? Risk of fire? What?
Representative Nelson, I think in this particular instance that we're talking about, it is the risk of the commercial activities, the commercial component of the financing. And particularly to housing investors that are looking at this development, they're saying, we understand that we can put the money into the housing portion of it, but if the loan is on the entire structure and the commercial portion, the retail or the office spaces, fails, and the lender has to then foreclose on that loan, it could take the affordable housing along with it because the loan covers the entire property.
Thank you. And last question, please. I was going to ask you, in what range, does all of the housing that is now being made a part of this with the commercial sector, is this all within a certain price range of the units? I mean, are they $165,000 units for the homeless, or are they $45,000 units?
Chair Criminal, Representative Nelson, I think that, again, that depends on a number of factors. One would be where you're building, first of all. I think the cost of building, you know, downtown Portland, where your land costs are significantly higher than, let's say, in Lakeview. Or I think it also depends on whether you're doing acquisition rehabilitations or new construction. So, you know, we see a whole range of cost factors. I'm not being very demanding.
I would appreciate having some information on that, because in Yamhill County, their idea of low-cost housing is $165,000 homes, and I just fail to agree with them on that. And I'm curious of the, maybe your department could give me the information of previous defaults of, you know, that you're aware of in type of situations.
Okay. Representative Chair Crummell and Representative Nelson, there have been no defaults.
And
going back to your question, when I think of affordable housing, I usually think of multifamily housing, not making single family affordable, although we do have some single family loans as well. But typically we're looking at $90,000 to $100,000 for the construction of a multifamily unit. New construction.
Okay. Just have one last comment.
Briefly.
One last comment. I just want to thank you for all you do for the individuals who need homes. I've spoken with other members of your department, and I think it's a critical need right now. The only way we're able to get affordable housing in my district is by going through Habitat for Humanity. And which I'd support, and I think that ought to be a part of your program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. Gillespie? Seeing none, thank you very much.
You.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill 2169? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2169, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2169.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
I move House Bill 2169 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Przanski moves House Bill 2169 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Are there any objections? Seeing none, House Bill 2169 has moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Let's see. Who would like to carry this bill? Representative Mabry, would you like to volunteer?
Sure.
Okay. Representative Mabry will be the carrier of 2169. Thank you very much. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2169. And I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2239. And, Patrick, while Gina's bringing the material up, how about if you give us a little rundown on this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2239 provides that a person must be a citizen of the United States in order to be employed as a telecommunicator, emergency medical dispatcher, police officer, corrections officer, or parole and probation officer, or to be utilized as a reserve officer. It exempts persons currently employed in these positions. The bill has no fiscal or revenue impact.
Okay. Thank you. And we have Eric Kablix. If you would come forward, please. And Mary, do you want to come up at the same time, or do you want to wait until you want to wait?
I'll wait.
Okay. Whenever you're ready, go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Gablix. I'm the Training Division Director at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, oftentimes known to as its acronym DPSST. I'm here this morning to provide information on House Bill 2239. This bill does two things, and let me start by telling you how this bill came forward to you today. On an ongoing basis, the department, working in partnership with its board and its committees, evaluates statutes and rules used to establish standards for training, certification, and the employment of public safety professionals. House Bill 2239 does two things. The first one, it adds the requirement for United States citizenship to public safety telecommunicators, those people who answer 911 calls, and emergency medical dispatchers. The bill also moves the requirement for citizenship for law enforcement officers to the hiring standard. Currently, that requirement is at the tail end of the process, which is just before they request certification. And through our process, it makes more sense to have as an employment standard as the others that we have set at the department and the board. This bill has been shared with our constituent groups, our board, and the various policy committees. And to our knowledge, there's no opposition to this bill.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Gablix?
Gablix.
Gablix. Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Avakian.
I'm inferring, I guess, just from the presence of the bill at all, that you think that citizenship status will ensure greater safety.
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, there's no way that we can ensure the safety. What we do is work in partnership with the cities and the counties and the state agencies that employ these people to set minimum employment standards. Those agencies do a background investigation of those people they're looking to hire. Those background investigations vary in their complexity and their depth based on the agency and their ability to do those investigations. What this does is it does put the requirement already, we have that for law enforcement officers. It does require it for public safety telecommunicators. And one of the things that it does do is that these positions have an incredible amount of public trust because of what they do, and they are the linchpin for the public safety response community. So when, for example, in a 911 center, a person would have access to all type of information on the public safety response to events that may happen. But it's not a fail-safe.
No, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up. Yeah.
I used the term greater safety specifically because I know you can't ensure absolute safety. But if the citizenship status isn't being used in this bill to ensure greater safety, I don't understand why it's present. And if that is true, tell me what part of the citizenship process of attaining citizenship directly relates to increased safety.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Akin, to my belief, this would increase the safety of our communities because I'll use the example of the 911 professional. Those employees are truly the first responder to any emergency that happens, whether it's an act of terrorism, whether it's a fire, whether it's a police emergency. They're the people that answer those phone calls that come in. They are also the people that understand the response mechanism of those communities to those type of events. What this requirement would do is require that those people go through the citizenship process to be eligible to be employed in that job. It doesn't guarantee that they'll be hired. For example, if I wanted to come in off the street and work in a 911 center, being a U.S. citizen doesn't guarantee me a job, but it does put me at the level where I have that requirement that puts me in a better position to have that.
Mr. Chair.
Follow-up?
Is it then more related to, I guess, qualifications or ability to perform the job as opposed to increased safety? Is that what I'm understanding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Akin, I would say that's correct. It is a hiring standard for a person desiring employment in this field.
Mr. Chair, just one more.
Follow-up?
Thank you.
Go ahead.
That being the case, help me out with what process in attaining, what part of the process in attaining citizenship makes one more eligible or qualified to perform the functions of these particular jobs?
Mr. Chair and Representative Akin, I would say that it's part of a larger fabric, if you will, and that is when we look at an employment situation, we set standards for employment, and what we see is that a person's citizenship as a United States citizen would illustrate or demonstrate that they have gone through the steps to become a United States citizen, and in fact they will be in many cases carrying out laws that are set by the United States government, and that would give them that background to understand how laws are made, how the United States government functions, and it would give them really something that right now is not required for telecommunicators, but it is for police officers and corrections officers.
May I have one more?
Yes, you may.
I think what you just described are terrific qualities for anybody to have working in public service. But my questions are more directed at these jobs in particular that you have listed in the bill. Mm-hmm. For instance, I think the qualities that you just described would be wonderful for anybody working in county mental health to have, or anybody in the taxation department to understand, you know, the processes and administration of government. Why these particular jobs are singled out in this bill as opposed to other governmental jobs that would be just as important?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Akin, I believe that the issue that the board and the department deal with is that our focus is very tight on people who are in the public safety setting. And what the legislature over the years has done is given the department and the board a number of directives to set minimum employment standards so that we have people of high integrity in those positions. Part of that task is to make sure that these agencies do a background investigation on those applicants. It is very difficult for those departments to do a background investigation on a person who's not a United States citizen.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you. I guess I want to kind of follow what Representative Bakken was following up on in his questions regarding the specific individuals that you're focusing on. When I went through the statutes and looked at the changes that are being contemplated, I understand today you can have someone actually be employed by a department that's not a U.S. citizen, but to get certification from the DPSST, they have to be a U.S. citizen. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, that is correct.
And currently a person as a telecommunicator or a dispatcher, they do not have that requirement either for the position with a law enforcement unit or getting certification from the DPSST.
Mr. Chair, Representative Perkins, is that correct? And if I could follow up, and maybe it'll explain it a little better, the hiring, the training, and the certification are all interconnected. And what I mean by that is that the agency goes through a process to hire that person. Then DPSSC provides them training. Then those people go back to the agency and continue their training with a coach. And then at the end of that process, they may be eligible for certification based on the performance of that person. So all three of those are required, and they're all tied together. So training and certification really are tied hand in hand.
I understand that. If I could... Mr. Chair, if I could go on.
Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
I guess now let me focus just on the telecommunicators. The good representative asked as to these particular individuals as to why they are being singled out
What tasks do you see that they are performing that would set them apart from other public service employees that would require U.S. citizenship?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, what actually happens is, and it's not a singling out, but what has happened is that the telecommunicators are the one of the most recent additions to the DPSST family. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that over the last decade or so, that profession has emerged into being one of the members of the constituency at DPSST. Originally, that group only sought training standards. The last session we came forward and with the work of those groups, they have now also requested minimum employment standards, physical, hearing, vision, those type of things. And this process is really the evolution of that. This change to telecommunicator emergency medical dispatchers will put them in the same footing, if you will, as the law enforcement officers that already have that requirement. So it really brings them into that same fold as the others.
If I could follow up.
So are you familiar with requirements or restrictions on non-citizens, such as in the National Guard, whether or not a non-citizen can serve in the National Guard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I'm not familiar with the National Guard, no, sir.
Would it surprise you that they can actually serve in the National Guard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I am surprised.
Okay. Did you also know that there was a case that's pending currently in California regarding the federal screeners for airport sites, where a group of individuals who had been applied in that employment who were non-U.S. citizens, either they were registered aliens or they are U.S. nationals, that have a claim on under equal protection as to them not being allowed to continue to work in those capacities or apply for the positions now that they've been taken under the federal government.
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I am familiar with some of the issues regarding the airport security functions. However, I think what's a little different in this situation is that this change for telecommunicators emergency medical dispatchers will apply to people coming into the profession from this date forward, not people that are currently in those jobs, which is really a big part of my understanding of the FAA airport situations, where people were in those positions that were taken out.
Let me just, if I could ask one other question.
Follow up.
Regarding equal protection, I think you just hit it on the head. Do you not think there's a problem here where you're going to allow individuals who still have the same status as residency to continue in those positions, but you're now going to say anyone new that does not have that U.S. citizenship is going to be prohibited from serving those positions? Do you not see an equal protection claim?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zansky, what I see through this statute is that we would be placing that as a requirement for employment. And I believe what that would do is that if I, as the individual seeking employment in a 911 center, I would know up front what's required of me. And this would be one of those things that I would have to be able to obtain so that I would be eligible for that job.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry for the
question. That's okay. Go ahead.
I guess what I'm not understanding, or you're not bringing me along with you, is that there are certain protections for citizens and non-citizens in this country as well as in the state. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the case law, it appears that unless in this particular case the government can show a strict scrutiny basis for applying that type of requirement, that we would in fact be at risk of having a challenge on equal protection grounds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I'm not aware of all the federal impacts of the issues that you're bringing up. I do know that the concern that a number of the constituents have is truly on the background check, and that is that when those agencies are making those decisions to hire those people, they want to make sure of the integrity of those people that are taking those critical positions in their communities. And the U.S. citizenship or lack thereof does impact the ability to do those background checks as thoroughly as agencies would like.
Do you believe that once someone becomes a U.S. citizen, that you're going to be able to do a better background check on them as compared to them being still in the status of non-citizen on the day after they become a U.S. citizen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, again, I don't believe it's a fail-safe mechanism, but I do believe it would provide those agencies the ability to do a better service in the background than they have ability to do now.
Are you satisfied? I mean, your question's answered?
I think my question's, I'd love to discuss this a little bit further. As a prosecuting attorney, I disagree with the last statement as to how someone's going to have a better background check result if you did it the day after they became a U.S. citizen as compared to having it done, I don't know when. I mean, the status of just becoming a citizen is not going to improve the ability to do a background check. You want an NCIC or CCH, and you're going to get the same information.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your questions. Are there other questions of Mr. Gavitt? Representative Nelson?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Mr. Gablex, is that right?
Gablex.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a bit concerned about this situation because I mean, it only applies to future people, but individuals who are already in these jobs could be in those jobs for 30 more years, and it seems an ambiguous situation. So I guess I want you to respond maybe to my office mm-hmm. of how you handle that ambiguous situation. And then next I'm concerned about the telecommunications position. I'm guessing that, you know, this is came out of the terrorism situation. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'd say that's secondary. Really, the primary reason that this issue was addressed is through the review of the statutes and the rules that we work under. So as we go through those, it was obvious to the committee that citizenship is not required for a telecommunicator, but it is for all the other disciplines served by DPSSC, police, corrections, parole, and probation. That was the primary one. I'd say that terrorism events of September 11th were secondary to this.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Mary. We will anxiously await your comments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I actually signed up as neutral on this bill until I heard the
testimony.
I need testimony.
You to state your name for the record, please.
I'm Mary Botkin, representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We represent 911 operators, corrections officers, many law enforcement people, and a variety of public safety personnel around the state, including LEDS, which does all the background checks, and I find it I wanted to kind of dash out and call our LEDS people and say, since when could we not do background checks on drug lords from other countries? We could if they were from ours. Because I was pretty sure we could do background checks on everybody. But evidently, according to DPSST, we can't do background checks if you're not an American citizen. Kind of cuts down on our ability to arrest those non-residential kingpins of drugs, doesn't it? We're actually not in favor of this bill because we haven't seen a demonstrated problem. First of all, we appreciate the fact that everybody who currently works is grandfathered in, but we don't even know for sure how many of our folks who work in the public safety arena are not U.S. citizens, and we certainly have not seen any demonstrated evidence that there's a problem, and we use a lot of interpreters. You know, I would suspect that probably some of our interpreters are probably not U.S. citizens but are here working legally. I find it appalling that somebody can serve the armed forces and go to Iraq and fight for this country but could not come home and go to work as a 911 operator. You know, that's just by virtue of its contradiction a little concerning to me. And I guess I just feel compelled to say this. Timothy McVeigh was an American citizen. nothing we did or could have done would have stopped what he did. And to indicate that your citizenship demonstrates some kind of loyalty to your neighborhood, your community, your state, or your country is a little concerning. We think that it is the responsibility of the public safety community to train the best public safety officials available to all of us, regardless of where they originated from. And I just want to see that there's a problem before we try to find a solution for it. And, you know, I have a hunch that we're probably not after Canadians. Or Irish.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Kipps?
I'm wondering, this question is potentially for Mr. Brzezinski, Representative Brzezinski. You said you stated earlier that the National Guard, you didn't have to be, and we had conversations about this last night. Does that apply to all branches of military, Army, Air Force, Marines, Navy, with that non-citizenship?
That's my understanding.
That's my understanding as well, Representative Kipps.
Okay. The second... Sorry, I always forget that part. Do the police, and I don't know if this is for Mr. Gablix or not, do the police, do the sheriffs and the troopers, are they in support of this, or do they have an opinion? Have they taken a stand on this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, we have shared this information with all of our constituents. Chiefs, sheriffs, 911, APCO is their group, Association of Public Safety Communications Officers, State Troopers, and no one has opposed this.
Are they in favor of it?
They haven't taken position by resolution, but they have not told us that they don't support it.
Okay. So could we surmise that they're neutral? I would hate to infer that they support it if they don't.
Right.
If they haven't taken a position saying yay or nay, I would hate to infer that they support or don't support it.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, for the law enforcement community, citizenship is already a requirement for certification. And what this does is it pushes that requirement from the back end before they get certified to the employment end at the front. So basically, rather than having an employee for 18 months in a police setting, it moves that requirement that it's up front that they have to have that before they're employed.
Follow up. My other concern comes from we're applying a measure here, a statute that comes into effect but doesn't have any retroactive effect. It in turn grandfathers in the existing, for lack of a better word, problems that the bill or the statute states to address. Is there a concern there with continuity? I.e., we're saying that if we've made this mistake before, it's okay, but we're going to rectify the problem in the future. And I guess that's that being part A of the question. Part B, I guess I'm failing to see, if you could explain to me, why this is needed. Is there a problem that exists that we're trying to correct by this statute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, the issue, and there's really two parts of this. For those people already employed in the law enforcement setting, moving it up as an employment standard allows those agencies to have that issue resolved before that person gets hired by the agency, as opposed to someone being trained at the academy. Then they go back to their agency and they can work for as many as 18 months as a police officer and then possibly not get their citizenship through the process and result in them being terminated from that job because it can't meet the state certification requirement at that end. The other issue as far as the grandfathering is for telecommunicators, it really is a process of where do we start when we implement this. And it's very similar to other processes that we've gone through over the past few years as we bring constituents groups on at the board and through the department, there has to be a starting point. And with this, really the reason for the grandfathering is to establish a starting point for new people coming into the system.
Follow up. Wouldn't it appear, and I don't know, and forgive my lack of knowledge on the subject, but wouldn't it appear that if there were a problem that required this action, that it should be retroactive to those that it would
apply to post this action if there were a problem, or should it not remain consistent? I mean, i.e., if there is a problem, let's remove those folks that are not citizens from their jobs. And if they're a threat, if they don't, because how can you keep it consistent? That's where I'm failing to make the connect.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, again, it's not that we're saying that those people that are currently in those 911 positions that may be from Canada or other places and not U.S. citizens are a problem. What we really looked at is where do we start with this new process for new people coming as an employment standard, and again, allowing those agencies to have the ability to do a more thorough background. And it's different than just doing a LEDS inquiry. It's actually accessing information about those people, you know, more than just, you know, were they arrested anywhere, those type of things. The background is more complex than that. So that's really the decision that was made, is to not go back and get involved in labor and contractual issues with people that are employed, and if they couldn't get their citizenship through in a certain amount of time, it's really to start at a certain point and move forward for new people coming into the system. Those people already employed are employed and are certified, and it will be very difficult to go back and take those people away from those positions because they've been there doing the job.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I make a comment? You know, one of the things, when I checked with our 911 dispatchers yesterday about this bill, one of the things that one of my dispatchers mentioned to me was that it was interesting that they had identified public safety personnel as defined in law, and yet they didn't reach out and cover the people who have access to the most sensitive material available. And that would be records clerks and IT people. And if you want to bring down public safety in America, just plant a virus in any 911 system. And by the way, the private sector does a lot of our 911 work. So, you know, I guess we're going to have to reach out and touch Quest and those folks, too. But, you know, I just have some concern about why we're doing this. I have yet to have demonstrated to me that there's some kind of a documented problem that says that we have infiltrators into the public safety system that are, you know, planning to bring us down. I'm not saying it's not there. I just want to see some evidence that it's there. Just because we're paranoid doesn't, you know, I mean, I guess my paranoia just doesn't stretch out that far. I go to our 911 centers all the time. And there are people, I mean, Hakeena Sim became a United States citizen, 5 years ago? Okay. And, you know, she has a questionable name. Thank you.
Hey, I'm not going to allow you to impugn other members of the lobby. Members, I'm going to cut off the conversation about this bill. I'm not going to take this bill to a work session. I would point out that the bill apparently has a constitutional problem. And so you may want to work on correcting that, and then advise the chair when you feel that the constitutional issues have been taken care of. And this bill will just sort of remain on hold until that time. Okay? Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2239. And members, thank you for that lively questioning and conversation with regards to it. I'm going to, because of our time factors, and we have some folks that have come from out of the area to testify, I'm going to move directly to House Bill 2281. That's the correct one, right? So that we can get that testimony, and so I'm skipping off of the agenda here for right now. We may not get to House Bill 2250 because we do need to end at 10:30. So just to, holy cow, Give everybody a heads up about what we're going to do here. The other bills have taken a little longer than what I originally thought that they would take. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2281, and I'm going to, Patrick, if you would please give us the lowdown here.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2281 prohibits state agencies from adopting any rule that is more stringent than federal requirements unless the state agency establishes conclusively that conditions in Oregon are unique or so different that application of federal requirements would not achieve the intent of the federal law or rule. The bill allows for the adoption of a non-complying rule if an emergency exists.
Okay. Thank you. And we have some folks that have come from out of the area, and I'm going to call them up first, and if it's all right, I'd like to call you all up together. David Alsap, James Mast, and Marilyn Kittleman, if you would please come forward and give us your testimony. And
Yes, my name is David Alsip. I live 421 South Elk Creek Road in Drain, Oregon. I'm a board member of Elk Creek Action Committee, which is a committee that most of us here formed about 2 years ago, helping to fight property rights for small landowners, small farmers, and small ranchers who we've been felt in the past have been left out of the processes of various things. But the history of this bill, we got involved in Senate Bill 1010 and the process of that over the last 3-4 years. And we come across in a lot of the process where there's a lot of bills and rules, mainly administrative rules, that the guidelines and the restrictions just comes out way stricter than what's applied to us by federal law, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act. These laws have been passed that exceed, and we all have to admit the small farmers and the ranchers have taken a beating the last several years. We're not being represented, and a lot of these rules that are being passed, we have a hard enough time as it is now, complying with the Clean Water Act and the various things. But what brought this to a head is there have been three recent court cases. One was State of Oregon versus Hayes. Then there was one in California, Palomino case. But all of these cases recently have ruled that DEQ has no authority, or EPA has no authority over non-point source pollution. Yet the state of Oregon, through administrative rules, has been getting bills passed to bring non-point source pollution under point source, where they can regulate our agriculture, our forestry, and our ranching. And we just can't, you know. And federal government says, federal law, that even in the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act, there's not a mention of non-point source pollution as far as relating to agriculture and forestry. But yet we're getting all these rules and regulations that are saying that they can regulate non-point source pollution. So therefore, it is really adding a burden, and it's basically doing away with the small farmers and the ranchers that are just doing what we can to survive. For one instance, this pesticide bill, that law that was passed that went into effect the first of the year, where you got to record everything to Oregon Department of Agriculture anytime you spray a little Roundup on your driveway or anything along that line. It's just these bills continuously going. And it's hard enough to follow federal guidelines. But when the state starts inflicting bills and rules through administrative rules against us, it's just making it a lot harder to survive. And that was the history of why we came by. Representative Cedric Hayden had talked to us. He's helped us with the committee, and we worked real close with Representative Cruz. But he suggested that if we had some bills, he knew some of these concerns, that he would submit them for us and have them read up if we put the bills in. We've done three bills, and this happens to be one of them. And I want to thank you for allowing us to, giving us a call to come up and testify, to let you know where the intent behind this bill, why we introduced it, and where it originated from.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Avakian.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming in. I want you to know how much we sympathize with the struggles that you've had, as you just described. One of my concerns, if you could speak to it, is that that our state's motto is that she flies on her own wings, and it means a great deal when you think in terms of us standing on our own two feet and not being controlled by the federal government, and the fact that states have rights to do what they think is best locally, separate from the dictates of the United States government. And this particular bill is so broadly written that it looks to me like we, in essence, shed our states' rights and allow the federal government to dictate what Oregon standards will be. How do you jive that with getting the protections that you think you need?
Well, I don't feel it's infringing, giving up our rights. Actually, it's given us more freedom of the state, because we've come a philosophy that in the last 2 years that we have dealt with, that everybody's afraid that if we don't make this bill, we don't do this ahead of time, federal government's going to come down on us. And here we end up it's come to a point where a lot of the rules, especially dealing with natural resources, we're better off under the federal Clean Water Act and what our own state is administering to us. So therefore, I think it's, as far as the freedom of our state to do what we want, it's more enhancing, I feel, it's more enhancing our state liberty to do what state would want.
Just one more question.
Follow up.
And I'll be done. Since the bill, though, applies to all state agencies, I would guess that if, for instance, the federal government wanted to set a very low standard for, say, standardized testing in public education, this would preclude our Department of Education from having a higher standard or a stricter standard. And so unless you can give me some argument that this would not apply to other agencies in that respect.
Well, that might be, like I said, that could be something. If it went into committee, we would very much like to work on, if it went on a committee to work on it. But I don't think that would hinder. I wouldn't know. I haven't looked in the edge. Like I said, we brought this up on as far as the natural resources. I know it would probably affect different agencies, but I really wouldn't know how. But if this went into a working committee or what you did, we'd very much like to have we got Representative Jim Welch is going to testify with the State Grange on this, because we adopted this a couple of years ago as a resolution in the State Grange, 2 years ago during the state session. But really, I just wanted to let you know what originated this and where we came from. I'm sure there probably will have to be some work on it, but if there is a working committee appointed, we would like to be represented as a committee in that working group.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Marilyn Kittleman. I am from Yonkala, Oregon, 2303 Elkhead Road. And I want to hit this from a little different angle. I'm on the Douglas County Planning Commission, so I can see this more from a planning viewpoint. But first, I want to address your concern, if I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bacon. I think that we, in fact, have put into this bill a very clear out for what you brought up in the education standpoint, and actually for other agencies also. If you look under Section 2, it actually says, unless the agency, after rulemaking procedures conducted pursuant to the ORS, established conclusively that the conditions in Oregon to which the rule applies are unique or so different. I believe that allows us, if we have an education problem conclusively, we can go on and fix a problem. However, I think what we have now in the state of Oregon is the shoot yourself in the foot first theory. And that's what we've seen in the agriculture end, but also in the planning and the education and so many others. I also agree with what you said, that most states would be terrified by going under federal government standards rather than states, because most states protect their laws. Our state has gotten so liberal and so broad that not only do they not protect us from the federal government, but they add layer upon layer upon layer of federal government and state government regulations. And where I see this bill going is it actually doesn't reduce regulation necessarily, but it clarifies the conflicts that Oregon puts on top of federal. I believe we have a very definite out. And unfortunately, I think it's too broad of a statement. I think that this statement under Section 2 leaves an out for almost any agency that wants one. I think they can go in, prove a little, do a little bit of testing, a little bit of science, and say, oh, we have a different problem. We need more stringent standards, and I would like to see it stricter. So I don't believe it needs to go to committee on that issue. However, the problems that I deal with on the Planning Commission, I just went through and listed four different easy-to-understand factors. One was the Coastal Zone Management Act, which any county who deals with the coastal real estate hits. And what this would ensure, this bill, would be consistency through coordinated planning. It would allow us to have very clear guidelines on what needs to be done without the state coming in then and saying, oh, by the way, I know you guys have met everything, but now you need to meet these. And sometimes those actually conflict each other. Number two would be Goal 5, Oregon Natural Resource Goals. And this would ensure that Oregon doesn't set another layer of regulation right on top of the already very stringent federal regulations. We have very stringent regulations federally when you talk about Natural Resource and Endangered Species Act. And I think also that number three is that we've seen Oregon playing out as this testing ground for anything that National Marine Fisheries Service or Army Corps of Engineer wants to put on top of us. They not only enact the normal federal guidelines, but then they act another 100 feet setback off of a river per se, without any scientific proof that that had any numbers of fish increase by doing that. They have no scientific proof to add it. They just go, oh, well, you know, I think this sounds like a good touchy-feely thing, so I think we should do it. I also think that our Oregon Supreme Court has traditionally been more liberal than federal courts, and unfortunately that has set this precedence for us to be here. And I think this bill would strengthen the rights of property owners. But even more than that, and this is another way that I see it affecting us, I think it affects the individual. It affects the individual business owners who want to come into our state who cannot meet our guidelines anymore and who choose then to go somewhere where they can set up a business and employ people. I think that that's directly related to why we have the highest rate of unemployment in the United States. I think that the reason that I can't approve many home sites in Douglas County now because of a slide plane. We had one slide back in, I believe it was 1996, and we had incredible amounts of rain, not typical amounts of rain. We had a slide that killed two people in their home due to a logging operation. Now, they didn't directly tie it in, but that's what they alluded that it was to. Now we have such a slide overlay in Douglas County that we can hardly approve a home site for people who have owned land, planned for their retirement, have a small family, and they can afford a small home. We now can't even approve their home site because of this. Now, our slide overlay is on temporary hold, but it's going to go into effect unless something's changed. And so I see it affecting individuals. It affects our rights to be able to build a home, to have acreage, to do a variety of different things. And I do think that it's very much protected by this very broad language for somebody who wants to push the issue. So I think we could reduce the unemployment and let us build some homes. Thank you.
I'm James Mast, 2169 Hayhurst Road, Yoncalla. I'm here representing both the Elk Creek Action Committee, and we formed Elk Creek Action Committee and Oregon Family Farms. I was very instrumental in starting that up back when Senate Bill 1010 came to Douglas County. It's a very far-reaching bill. And, of course, they write their administrative rules from that and take even more of our property rights. Every time we get a rule or a law handed down to us, we just lose another slice of our property rights. Every time, like the Senate Bill 1010, you guys gave ODA a bill to work with, but then they write a rule and another rule, and they keep taking slices of the pie. This is one of the reasons why we talked to Representative Hayden about helping us write a bill. Our state has been currently going way overboard on its rules and lawmaking. Everyone is so afraid of the feds, but it's our state and its policymaking that we need to be in fear of. In answer to Mr. Bacon's, Representative Bacon's deal, or when he's talking to Dave there, the state government is infringing so much further into our rights and our property rights. And like Marilyn was saying, this slide rule, the American dreams to own a home and buy a piece of property and build a home, and that's going away from us because of state regulation. I'd like to give you a couple of examples. They touched on the non-point source pollution rules and laws. Everyone was saying if we don't do this to ourselves, that the feds under the Clean Water Act will take everything that we have through the heavy fines. But the fact is the Clean Water Act under Section 303D is for point source, but the Clean Water Act very specific under Section 319 where it talks about non-point source being delegated to the states as a voluntary incentive-based program. And here we can be fined up to $10,000 a day under Senate Bill 1010. That's what I'm talking about, the state going way overboard regulating the people. The last session, you guys instigated a pesticide law. I bought an old rundown ranch that was covered with blackberries. No fault of my own, but I have to clean those blackberries up. And then you can mow blackberries, and they grow back thicker than they started out. They just sprout more sprouts. The only way you can deal with those is herbicides. Every time you get a bottle of herbicide or a pesticide, there's a label on it. Most of the time you pull that label out, and it's a regular pamphlet, and it tells you where to apply it, how close to water. Each different herbicide has its own set of rules with it. And that's a federally mandated label. But the state decides that we have to have a pesticide law, which even with our economy here in the state, the budget problems we're having, we didn't need that pesticide law. I think they got it on hold now because of the budget. But it's another layer of bureaucracy that we just don't need. The regulation is that's the part that's hurting us. The fish under Judge Hogan's decision was plain. Count all the fish, not just a select few. Our ODF&W has a better idea. Kill enough of them off until we have just a few fish left in the state. And that's just a flawed science and a flawed ideology. We do not have a fish problem in the state. We have a regulatory policy problem in the state. Once again, they write their own rules and they write their own regulations in there. We need to help support this bill, need to have you help us support this bill to get this state back to where our natural resource people can once again turn a profit, not a heavy-handed state government looking down a gun barrel at us. Educate us. Don't regulate us. This is a much-needed common-sense bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, may I make one more comment?
Yes.
If possible. I just wanted
more brief.
Real, very brief. I just wanted to say I heard in an earlier testimony that what the gentleman had brought up, he said, you know, I don't see affordable housing necessarily as being individual single houses, but I do think that's the American dream. I mean, we may need them in town. And we've got a poster on our local little tiny hardware store in town, and it says, why is it easier in Oregon to get on welfare than to get a building permit?
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any absolute dying questions that need to be asked of these witnesses? You just got to ask.
I just wanted to ask Chair Kremel, why has it taken us so long to get to this? And I'm so grateful to the good Representative Hayden. And he was my next-door neighbor and all those 20-something years here. And I'm sorry they redistricted him out.
We're going to fix that.
You go.
Excuse me. Can I say one more thing? Very
yes.
Short. If you guys do
such a long ways, yes.
If you guys do go to committee, if we could be represented there, it would be greatly appreciated.
Okay. Thank you. Members, what I'm going to do, because we have run out of time, and everybody else that is signed up for this bill is from Salem or within a pretty close range. So I'm going to, what we will do is we will bring this bill back for further public hearing on Thursday. That's the day after tomorrow. And we will schedule kind of light because I can see that this is a pretty hot topic. And so I'm going to ask those that have signed up, and we will save this list, but I'm going to ask those that have signed up, if you would please come back on, that didn't come from a long ways away, to please come back on Thursday. We will also take up House Bill 2250 on Thursday as opposed to trying to do it today because we are out of time, and I don't feel that it's fair to you as members to keep you over time. Representative Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, is it the Chair's intent to have this come up first, or will we just continue
yes.
to allow the people?
Yes. Yes, this bill will come up first on the agenda on Thursday, so that people that want to speak on it certainly may. Okay. If there's now one other thing before you leave, members, I have a request from Representative Kitts to suspend the rules and allow us to reopen the work session on House Bill 2169 so that he may have a recorded vote. Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, I'm going to do I need to actually make a motion to do that? Okay. I'll make a motion to suspend the rules so that to reopen the work session on House Bill 2169. Seeing no objection, okay, we've done that. Now, I need to ask for a motion. Let's see. I can just make the motion, right? Okay. I'm going to reopen a work session on House Bill 2169. And Representative Kitts, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Kitts votes aye on House Bill 2169. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2169. And thank you, committee, for your attention today. And we will stand adjourned.